was sort of like a... Oh, okay. I didn't hear my cue. Welcome, everybody, to Eye to the Sky, the UFO synopsis here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network. I'm your host, Dee Andrew. Tonight, my guest is Rob Simone. Rob Simone is the host of his own radio program, where he interviews some of the most fascinating people on the planet. He has written articles for many well-known publications and has authored several books. He has worked for CAUSE, Citizens Against UFO Secrecy. Rob has been featured in several documentaries, as well as an episode of History Channel's program, Decoding the Past. He was recently included in Fate Magazine's Top 100 Ufologists list, and also was on Coast to Coast AM here recently. And I'm thrilled to welcome Rob back to the show. Welcome back, Rob.
Hey, it's great to be back. Thanks, Dee.
Hey, I'm glad to have you. You know, we've been talking back and forth here recently about the Rockefeller Initiative, and you had the opportunity to speak with Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
And I'm talking about the UFO subject.
Yeah, the Rockefeller Initiative is of course, it's not an official title. It was something that was just, it's a bit of a label. And what that label addresses is Lawrence Rockefeller popping in and out of the White House in the early 90s and talking with Bill Clinton. We don't know what he was talking about with Bill. But what we do know is that Lawrence, during that time, was pushing for the release of documents that relate to the UFO issue. And he wrote several letters that we have from Freedom of Information requests that reflect his urging that some of these things be released. And he consulted with other ufologists, and of course the Rockefellers and family has spearheaded several campaigns that have researched this phenomenon. So it's very interesting to think that Bill and Lawrence had a bit of a conversation and about UFOs, and it's something that we can only assume that Hillary was, part of the conversation. And as I met with her at a fundraiser in Beverly, Wilshire, in January, she was there. She did know about it, and she pushes for she's always said she pushed for transparency in government, and that's evident because, well, I mean, I was going to say that it's the back end of the story is that after the Clintons left the White House, of course, John Podesta, the former chief of staff, which is no small position, called publicly for the release of UFO documents. So there is a thread there through the Clinton administration that does deal with UFOs. It's not a very strong thread. It's a rather thin one, but a thread nonetheless.
That's very interesting because Grant Cameron was going through last week and was telling, you know, the involvement of Hillary and Podesta and quite a few other individuals.
Yeah. Yeah. And what do you make of that?
I'm intrigued. I have to tell you, I'm really intrigued on, you know, what was said, what we don't know, what was said, mm-hmm. You know, and that the Clintons did try to get information out to the public.
Yeah, Bill, of course, from what I've heard, wanted to know two things. He wanted to know if UFOs were real and who shot JFK. And he sent Webster Hubble out to find the answers to these questions, but he was turned down. And I think that the larger picture of this is, well, which presidents have been briefed on the UFO issue and which have not? And of the ones that have, does it fall down party lines? Does it relate to the fact that in the intelligence community, more of them are Republicans than Democrats. Does this translate into a Republican president being more likely to be briefed, I wonder? Or does it relate to the actual president's pull and connections and affiliations with certain military agencies? I mean, if George Bush's father was head of the CIA, that puts him in a different category than someone who's president that was just, say, a congressman or a senator or a governor of a state. So it's hard to know which ones have and which ones haven't, but I had the opportunity to sit down with Shirley MacLaine in her home in New Mexico, and we talked for about 5 or 6 hours all about UFOs, and she said that she was friends with Jimmy Carter, which, of course, is no secret. But what was a secret at the time that she told me was that she was on the phone with Jimmy Carter just about every day while she was making that film, Out on a Limb. And he told her that he was trying, as he promised in his campaign, because he did, you know, witness a UFO before he became president, years before, and actually filled out a report and was asked about it. And was one of the things that he was, you know, trying to do was get some information either for himself or to get some sort of hearing on it, or some sort of a congressional hearing on it. But he told Shirley MacLaine that he was turned down at every attempt. He was blocked from getting that information. So the apparatus of the government is built into different sections. And the people that, say, make up the naval intelligence don't have an open book to what the CIA has, nor does the CIA have an open book to what the NSA has, nor does any other departments have, you know, a walk-in open-door policy to all the other departments. It goes through liaisons. It goes through old boy connections. It goes through, you know, whether if you're a Yale alumni or not, you might get more information. That's, unfortunately, that's how it works. Not to mention these very classified departments of the military that even the military itself doesn't have all the answers to. So it's a deep, dark world we've built ourselves into, and it's a wonder that things have gone as well as they have so far, given all of the secrecy and all of this dysfunctionality of our own very important military and industrial complex, and our intelligence complex as well. It's a mess. It's full of secret societies and handshakes and alliances and different different agendas. It's one big mess. As I say, the failure on 9/11 to scramble planes out of Edwards Air Force Base might be an indication that at any given time, things work, and then sometimes things don't work. When it comes to foreign policy, when it comes to espionage, sometimes they work and sometimes they don't.
Well, like you were saying, you know, that Edwards was slow to scramble jets at 9/11, but then again, they sure weren't slow to scramble jets for unidentified in, was it 92? Or 2002, rather, in July?
Oh, 2002 July. I remember that. Yeah, I remember what you're talking about. That where there was something floating in the air over controlled airspace near D.C.
Right.
Was that it? Yeah.
Yeah, and I talked to one gentleman who was an eyewitness to that event, and he said he saw at least two fighters going after that object.
Mm. Yeah, it was some, like, 84 minutes after the first plane hit the tower. All that time, not one jet was scrambled out of Edwards. But the funny thing is, during the course of a regular year, Edwards Air Force Base scrambled anywhere from 50 to 60 to 80 planes a year just on routine occurrences, like if an airplane deviates from its course a little bit, or if there's an unruly passenger on board that gets radioed in, or if there's a loss of transponder signal, automatically one will go up. So, you know, it's just one small example of how dysfunctional our government is. And as I say, it's a wonder we're not in a bigger mess than we are. But when it comes to UFOs, it's an even bigger mess, because you have this disbelief. You have this it's almost as if there is a big part of the government that should be worked on and focused on. We should have a whole department based on this, coordinating efforts, one that handles the information, one that handles contact. And since everyone's pretending it doesn't exist, there's this whole area of government that the government should be working on and addressing, not only between liaising between people and the government and perhaps off-world intelligence and in our government. Since it's not there, then we're going around it and underneath it and over it. And a lot of times, we're not even addressing any of it. So there is a big chunk of our government that's missing, and it's left up to the secret squirrels. It's left up to, who knows, MJ-12. God only knows. And that could be a real problem when it comes to sending mixed signals to potential ET visitors that might think that they speak for all of us, when in fact they don't speak for really any of us.
This is true. There are several organizations out there that think they have all the answers when they don't.
You've got to wonder. I mean, if the MJ-12, I mean, I recently interviewed Dr. Dan Burrish, and he was part of this MJ-12, Majestic, and he told me stories of their conflicts with the Illuminati and the conflicts that are drawn between the European faction of this global cabal and the American faction of this global cabal, and they have different agendas, and they were both recruiting Dan, this Area 51 scientist, who actually worked directly with a live extraterrestrial, kept at Area 51, supposedly, that they sort of captured after the Kingman, Arizona crash of 52. But he tells stories that, really makes you wonder who has been our interface between the government or this society, this MJ-12, and ET visitors. The question also comes to mind is maybe they've already been in touch. Maybe there has been a treaty signed, and maybe there has been some sort of deal made. I mean, we never would know about it either way.
You know, the scary thought of it is if there was some kind of a deal made, was the idea of debunking sightings and saying people, oh, they're hallucinating or they're drunk or, you know, some other stupid explanation is part of that deal.
Yeah, I've heard different theories on it, and I'm not quite sure what to make of it. I mean, they're with these ET visitors. I mean, they could have been here since the 40s, the 50s. So there's no telling, if there is a deal, how long it's been established. But I wouldn't put anything past anybody. I mean, I just wrote a book called UFOs and the Headlines, and that's just 100% news articles going back to the 50s onwards. And you clearly see that there was stuff going on in different countries back then, and all over Europe. The Air Force was aware of them. In fact, in one article, the Air Force admits that some UFOs are not from this Earth. And that's a little sort of admission that's gone unnoticed for about 50 years, because that article came and went. And it wasn't until I found it that we realized that they did admit at some point that these UFOs represent extraterrestrial presence. So if they're willing to admit that to a newspaper back in 1952, there's no telling how further afield those contacts went. I mean, if anybody's going to get a chance to engage an extraterrestrial entity, chances are it's going to be either the Air Force or the Army or the Navy. So I think our best bet lies with the Air Forces of the world, and they could be our unofficial representatives. Or NASA. Who knows what they're up to up there?
Oh, that's for sure.
Yeah. So we find ourselves in a very strange part of history, which there's no real precedent. We can't look back in history and say, well, we've seen this before, but no, we haven't, because this is a first for all of mankind. The possibility that we're all going to get proof that we're not alone, and second of all, if it already happened, and who is the one that has represented us. And we might find out that they haven't been representing us in good faith or with our best intentions.
This is true. You know, and one thing that I've been discussing with a lot of people as well is the change in the media presentation of the subject. It's been less giggle factor, you know, old silly people seeing lights in the sky type thing, to a little more serious reporting.
Yeah, we have seen some news, haven't we, on the thing that happened out in Texas, the Stephenville.
Yes, and also Larry King Live extensively covered the Stephenville incident.
That's true. We devoted a whole hour to it, and it wasn't very long after he just did a show about UFOs.
And I was watching CNN last night, and they had a little blurb going up, you know, the little ticker across the bottom of the screen.
Yeah.
They said on there that tomorrow night they're on Larry King is going to be another one.
Wow.
I don't know if it's a rerun of one that's already been aired, but they're going to show another one.
Interesting. Yeah, it's really coming into to the mainstream more and more. And I know I've been approached by different television networks. They want to develop some TV shows that have to do with this, some reality shows that have to do with the subject. And we're really seeing it everywhere. It's a very hot topic. And, you know, TV is understanding that they put on a show about UFOs and they're going to win their time slot because it's a hands-down winner. Everyone is dying to know about this. And the mainstream people who just get their news from television and radio, regular radio, don't get to understand these things. And they're really hungry for information. So, yeah, I think we'll be seeing a lot more about this. And I hope that we'll get more answers. But, you know, what I've learned from being in this field for a while is that you don't get the answers that you want. I mean, recently we've been shown by NIDS, the Discovery Science apparatus set up by Bob Bigelow, that good reporting and good investigation in UFOs and abductions had turned up the fact that we're seeing all kinds of phenomena happen simultaneously to people and places. We're seeing poltergeist-type phenomenon happening in places that were once thought only to have some sort of ET or abduction phenomenon going on. So we're seeing this mingling of phenomenon, which further baffles us because it's something you wouldn't expect, and it's making us sort of having to reevaluate the whole area of the paranormal. I was having a discussion with someone that, you know, at the end of it, we realized that we had to pull back and maybe not just divide up the field from ghost to UFO. It could be that these phenomena are at the root related somehow. And I know that sounds strange, but we're seeing this commingling of phenomena happening more and more in the very well-documented, very thoroughly researched cases that almost defy explanation, because it's hard enough to accept poltergeists and ghosts and all these things. It's even harder to think that they're happening in the same place for unknown reasons. And so it's definitely a new frontier of the human consciousness that we're really exploring when we dive into the UFO phenomenon.
Oh, yeah, the paranormal. One of my favorite programs on Sci-Fi Channel is Ghost Hunters. Those guys rock.
Yeah, they do. They absolutely do. And that what they're showing is that there's a lot of stuff going on if you take the time and sit down for 5 hours and really start to focus on it. But the shortcut to what they're doing is for people to realize if they want answers, if they want to explore this phenomenon, all they have to do is really bring it into their mind and really take a serious step forward towards it. As I said before, you take one step toward a larger reality, it takes two steps towards you. So yes, you can sit down for hours and hours, but if you really want to go out and meditate or whatever, however you want to come at it, If you want to try opening up a communication, you know, through various means at your disposal or things that you've learned, the first thing you got to do is try it earnestly. Because you know what? You'd be surprised. If you really put your intention towards it, you're going to come up with some results.
Well, getting back to the talk you had with Hillary, what kind of information did she tell you?
It wasn't really the fact that she gave me information. As I said, it was something that it was a fundraiser, so we wanted to find out. I tried to bring up the subject, and she was aware of what Rockefeller was doing, and of course she was in the White House at the same time. So it really wasn't like an information exchange; it was a confirmation.
Okay. What all did she tell you then? Like, who was involved, or...
No. I mean, again, Lawrence Rockefeller was the only guy that was involved.
Okay.
And he was visiting the White House. So it's really through him, and the fact that she was at his ranch during that time. It's a thin thread. It's a very thin thread there, but I was really surprised that... it seemed like she had an answer ready for this particular question. I think that was, to me, that was the most surprising. It was almost as if she anticipated someone asking her. And she couldn't have been more off guard because, I live in Los Angeles here. And through a contact of mine, I got to go to this $3,000 a plate fundraiser through an invitation. And, it was sort of late in the evening. And, I would have been surprised if she just, came off the cuff and, I think someone briefed her on this, like, hey, we know this is coming, and here's what we say when you're asked. Because they do that for everything. Policy, mm-hmm. Iraq, abortion. So it's quite possible they did one for UFOs, too. Because nobody knows more than she does and her people how deeply involved in this she was. We all think it goes a lot deeper. I think that she was at the ranch. She did talk to Lawrence Rockefeller. She was talking to Bill. She knew about Webster Hubble going looking for information. And she's probably seen some information and talked to a lot of people who know a lot of stuff. Now, it doesn't help her political career to come out and talk about it. But I think she's a smart person, and I think she's intelligent. And intelligence is coupled with a curiosity. And so there's no telling how far down the rabbit hole Hillary went. She wanted to go down further, being the first lady, because she would have the luxury of time at her disposal, where Bill, was probably occupied doing different things or different people.
What do you think the chances are that if she does get elected as president, she'll do more digging into the subject?
I think it's very, very high. We see here an example or possibility, an opportunity, rather, for someone who has not been part of the normal track that leads someone to the office of the president. We're seeing someone coming in through a side door, and I think in this world, in this day and age, that can only mean good things.
I'm hoping so.
I'm
hoping that she does get elected.
Yeah.
That she does do digging and something does come about from it.
Yeah. And I'll be watching, the headlines of the newspapers. I'll be watching the news because we're going to follow this very closely. And we're not going to let down our motivation and our efforts to get more answers on the subject, because this is just as important as anything else that they are asked during the course of the campaign.
Well, it's been a fascinating subject, with Grant Cameron and his work on the different presidents and their involvement and whatnot. When this whole thing comes about, which president that we've had do you think may have come the closest?
The closest, huh? I think Reagan was really trying to do some things that we might not be aware of. I heard a story from someone here in Los Angeles who knows a little bit about the old guard of Hollywood. And, of course, Ronald Reagan lived in Los Angeles. He was an actor, and he was part of that whole old-school Johnny Carson celebrity crew. And I heard one time he and Nancy were driving to a dinner party for someone, you know, some Hollywood dinner party, and they saw something on the side of the road, and they pulled over, and they had a close encounter of the first kind. Whether it's true or not, I don't know. But I kind of, I don't discount it out of hand. I think Reagan was fascinated by the subject, and those little references that he made in his speeches about an alien invasion, I don't think came about through pure chance. So he might have, and he definitely might have been briefed on this in one way, shape, or form, because there were different times back then. I don't think the iron hand of secrecy was clenched as tight back in the 80s with him. So it's hard to say, but he might have been one that dived a little deeper than most, and we can only imagine what will happen. I mean, what about, if Barack Obama gets elected? Who knows what his thoughts are on the subject?
Well, from what I understand, he kind of wants to cut NASA's budget and do more like health care and that kind of thing.
Well, you're right. He is someone who is interested in public service programs, but someone who is liberal in his thinking and who has a worldly point of view. I mean, remember, George Bush, he didn't have a passport until he became president. So he had very, very small idea of how the world actually works. But Barack Obama, no, I think he might be someone who could really make some changes in the way we see ourselves, the way we look at ourselves and our place in the universe. It, who knows what could happen during his presidency. And again, would he be briefed? I doubt it, but we can wait and see.
Do you think Hillary would be?
Hillary, I think, has got a better chance. She's got a lot of pull in Washington. She's a power player. She's made a lot of great contacts. She might not be well-liked by the military, but I think her contact list is pretty strong. So, big possibility with her,
Considering all the different presidents, and I know, if I remember correctly, it was Jimmy Carter that was told he didn't have the need to know. Do you think any president would really have the ability to force or even start some kind of a disclosure?
Well, a president could make some bold changes, absolutely. With his pull, he could direct people to do things, get an open hearing on the matter, absolutely. And now, as far as prying the information out of these closely guarded, compartmentalized agencies and projects, well, that's a different matter. But yeah, a motivated president could do a world of change. He could talk about it from his very lofty platform, most powerful man in the world, talking about the need to know this larger reality. It would be earth-changing, and there's no telling what momentum or inertia that would be generated by a president going down that road that would be reciprocated and propagated by the rest of the world, and what effect all of that would have on this movement. So it's interesting to think, but I tend to believe that it wouldn't come from a president. It's not how the machine works. And the office of the president is a bit of machine work that goes on. So I don't know how or when the tipping point will occur, but I dare say coming right from the mouth of a president would be a long shot.
Well, like I've said quite often, president is only in office for 4 years, eight if they're lucky. You know, presidents come and go, but the intelligence community, the military community stays.
And it has also been said that a paradigm change happens one funeral at a time. So in a way, we're waiting for the old guard to die off and the new ones to come in. I mean, we thought we were done with Cheney a long time ago. Kind of, you know, he disappeared back in the 80s after Reagan. And bam, he's back. So it really needs to be a changing of the guard. We, you know, I get some new blood in there. And that's the only way things actually turn the course.
It's an interesting way of putting it, one funeral at a time. But, you know, when you kind of think about it, even in the sciences, that's true.
In many things, yeah. Yeah, especially when it comes to people who are holding, you know, holding positions of power like that. Because, you know, more and more of the world's power is falling into fewer and fewer hands. So when it comes to this type of edifice, this built-up establishment, then, yeah, the only way things change is by, you know, a funeral. So sometimes it's a slow process.
Do you think that people like Stephen Bassett are on the right track, or do you think that people can voice their opinion strongly enough to force some kind of an info release?
Well, it has worked in the past, and we also have seen plenty of times when sometimes loud voices fall on deaf ears. So both are true. When it comes to Steve Bassett and this movement, he's certainly not alone. There are a lot of people calling for the release of information. Of course, Steve puts together the X conference, and that's the 18th of April, right near Washington D.C. So it's a couple weeks, and his methodology of putting together these conferences, I think, is sound. I mean, what other alternatives do we have? You know, we can hold a press conference, or we can do a full-length information conference. Great. The only way to really affect change is to engage the media and engage this this process, engage the web and these news agencies. And when you have news, when you have information like we do, us in the field, then, yeah, we should get some of the stuff out because it's very important. The conference is 18th through the 21st of April next month, and it's going to include a press conference at the National Press Conference. And they're going to, Dr. Edgar Mitchell is going to be there.
Former Apollo astronaut.
That's right. Yep, sixth man to walk on the moon. And he's going to have a host of other PhDs and dignitaries. I'll be speaking there about my book, UFOs in the Headlines. And what we're doing is presenting very solid information. We're not interested in ideas or imagination. We're saying, look, here is what we know, and here is what's going on now. What are we going to do about it? So this is a very big topic. I mean, this is equivalent to the Civil Rights Movement in the 50s. I mean, this really is about people's spiritual autonomy.
You know, I hadn't thought of it that way, but you're right. It is like, you know, the Civil Rights Movement. This is our civil rights of knowing what our government's hiding.
The reason that I've tied it into the civil rights, because when I talk about the spirituality of disclosure, I make this comparison between the Civil Rights Movement of the 50s, because we, as ufologists or people who believe that our government's keeping us secret, we have the truth, okay? And most of the rest of the world has the same truth, that we know we're not alone. And we know these attempts of secrecy shall not deter us from understanding this truth. So the world, when I say the world, I really mean our government of Europe and America, is going to have to catch up with us. They need to come up, because we're ahead of them. In the 50s, the civil rights movement, they had the truth. They knew about equality, and they knew that there was no way around it. And yes, the world caught up to them, and it wasn't easy. There was some disruption, but you know what? We're better off for having done it. Same way with the UFO phenomenon. Our government, the world, is going to have to catch up with us, because we're ahead of them. Also, on the other side of the coin, I talk about this, that if it's proven that the government has been covering up information and has been lying to us about this profound understanding of our place in the universe, then they are guilty of a crime against humanity.
I agree. Hiding technology and who knows what all else.
Well, yeah, because, look, our faith depends on our understanding of our place and ourselves. So to form a belief system, to subscribe to any religion, to grow as a person, to grow spiritually, and to be denied this very profound reality, denies people of their life, liberty, and pursuit to advance as a personal and spiritual being. So it is in spite of the government on this particular point that we have to ourselves have disclosure for ourselves personally. Don't wait for the government to say it's okay. If we bring this reality into our hearts and minds and accept it fully, then we will be speeding up the disclosure process. It's quite possible that we create this field of mind, and with a very large acceptance, with an open-mindedness, comes a larger reality. One of the reasons that Mexico might be having all these incredible sightings is because the Mexican people are really into this, they believe in it, they understand it, and they're open to it. So consequently, they will invite a larger experience that could explain why their sightings have been astronomical over the past 10 years.
I agree. Japan is very open about it. And China is very open about it.
Oh yeah, they're way into it over there. It's not to say that, like, over Phoenix you wouldn't have a sighting, but generally speaking, I think there's something to it, and it could also explain the great civilizations of Sumer and Egypt. I mean, here these civilizations were all open to it. There was no debate, and they, perhaps because of that, had an incredible information at their disposal. They built the pyramids with the Mayan calendar. They did this incredible feats as humans that today we can't match. It could very well come down to a collective openness of our mindset that gives us the foundation to explore greater aspects of our human potential.
Well, on this media thing, here a couple of years ago, I wrote an article that was up on the ICAR website on the what I referred to as an educational program I don't know whether the term desensitizing the public or educating the public or just making the idea a little more acceptable is out there in our media. Programs like History Files, or History Channel, UFO Files, Larry King doing his program, all these UFO documentaries you see on TV now, UFO imagery in commercials, children's programming. Do you think there's something behind that?
Yeah, I've heard about this and seen some of it myself. Not only in America, but traveling through very remote places in the world and surprised by these toys and these images of alien faces. I don't know whether it could be manipulated that these things come out the way they do. That I'm not sure of, but it's also unclear why it would be necessary, because people are quite able to take on new information and new realities. So the whole idea, to me, doesn't ring true because I can't appreciate the end game, the importance of it, you know, as far as indoctrinating people or getting them used to this or used to that. I'm just not sure that such an elaborate undertaking would be able to do that. And in the end, I'm not sure that that would be such an important thing to do. So, yeah, that one to me is a bit of a head-scratcher.
I know, oh gosh, like a year or so after I wrote that, Karen Dolan did a piece on it. Peter Robbins was looking into it. You know, it's just amazing to me. I mean, even the Ever Ready Bunny, I guess, could now be considered an abductee.
Right. Yeah, we're seeing, and you see it everywhere. I mean, you see it in China, in Asia, in Europe. I mean, it's everywhere. And I don't know that this particular form of advertising or interest necessarily needed to be fueled by a clandestine group of operatives. I think it's something that people latch onto anyway.
Oh, well, what kind of triggered me to look into this was one of Jenny Randall's books. I have several of them here. I'd have to dig through them and remember which one it was. But in this particular one, she was talking how she had been speaking with a member of Parliament or House of Lords or whichever, I forget which. And he told her that people in Hollywood, and he specifically mentioned Steven Spielberg, as being part of this educational program.
Really? Well, you know, in my book, UFOs in the Headlines, there are articles there by Arthur C. Clarke, who is, you know, enormously responsible for interjecting these ideas into movies and popular culture. And he was quoted, he actually wrote in an article, I think it's page 16, he talks about Paul Trent's photos, these classic UFO photos, and he's commenting on life outside the solar system. And the Duke of Edinburgh is talking about UFOs. He was interested back in the 50s. And so I think even before that, this program and Steven Spielberg was even, you know, doing anything, we already see a great interest in these UFOs. And we see that they came from different levels. So, there's such a momentous fascination with this subject, and to see it reflected in actual newspaper articles from the 50s onwards is, to me, proof that there was real reporting once, and they were reporting on real phenomenon, and people were really interested, and it is something that lies somewhere deep inside all human consciousness. And, it, of course, under a free press, it will get reported on and noticed. And if people, by the way, want to take a look, there is a free preview my book, UFOs in the Headlines. It's just go to robsimone.com, and they can have a peek.
Oh, I have a copy of that book. It's wonderful. You don't even have to really, you know, start at the front and work to the back. You can just open it up anywhere and start reading. It's great.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, it's something that, you know, is for everybody. You know, whether you're a diehard researcher or, you know, somebody who just likes interesting coffee table books.
Oh, it is. It's cool. It's something that you can just pick up and just thumb through and just read whichever one catches your eye or whatever.
Yeah.
And, you know, and since you mentioned Arthur C. Clarke, I have to say I was very saddened to hear of his passing.
Oh, did he? Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
Just a few days ago, actually.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, he did. He was living down in Sri Lanka, and he lived a full life.
That's where he was when he passed away.
Was it? Okay.
He will be missed.
Yeah. Yeah. What a legend. And I think he paid for that special service where you get some of his ashes, and they shoot it up in a rocket, and they release it, and it burns up over the atmosphere.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Gene Roddenberry.
Yeah, Roddenberry did. I think Jerry Garcia did it. Yeah, it's
Timothy
like,
Leary.
Timothy Leary I think did it too. Yeah, I think it costs about $30,000, and you can become part of space in memoriam if you want to.
Oh, and if you want to go one step further, my husband David here recently, just a few days ago, found online that there is a civilian service that will crash your ashes onto the moon.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah.
But that's just the space cadet in me, you know. yeah, chuckle moment there.
Yeah.
But, you know... When it comes to the media, you know, there's still a little bit of the giggle factor there, but it's not quite as prevalent as it used to be.
Well, yeah, I think that I think we're getting better cameras now, and we're getting better connectivity, so we can rule out a lot quicker things that can be ruled out. So by the nature of our increasing sophistication, when something does happen, we're able to pull together a lot of resources to either confirm or deny it. So if something does rise to the level of a news report, then, you know, it tends to be more substantive. So yeah, I think that I think people can't turn away as easy as they could before because it's so much easier for people to see so much more stuff. So by the nature of the increased quality and quantity of information, it's going to be something that everyone's going to have a better idea of, and when they see it, they're going to see it much more in depth. So yeah,
well,
it's good news.
Well, yeah, better cameras, smaller, more compact cell phone cameras.
Yeah.
You know, I personally hardly go anywhere without a camera nearby.
Right.
And a lot of people are getting into that mode where they've got some way of capturing an image, be it their cell phone or a camera or a video camera.
Yeah.
Do you think because of this we're seeing a lot more photographs and video footage?
Yeah, cameras are everywhere. When you walk outside your door, just assume, even when you're inside, just assume that you're on camera because they can hide them. They're in the walls. They're on telephone poles. They're in intersections. They're literally everywhere, and stores. People are putting them up. They're in cars. I mean, so yeah, this world is becoming more and more surveilled. So the more people that have their fingers on the record button, the more that we're going to see some of this stuff. So yeah, it is like cracks in the dam. You know, it's getting more and more information through it.
Well, I've been noticing a lot of people too are turning to the internet to get their photographs and their videos out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I spoke last year at the X conference, and there was a girl there with her father. She must have been in sixth, seventh grade, and she was doing a report about UFOs. And I told her that she wanted a quote. I think my quote was, "The truth is not in your textbook. It's on the internet." And
valid point.
And the more I thought about it, the more I really believe that you know, the internet really is changing life as we know it. Because if you have any question, whether it is the chemical compound of a particular substance or anything else, you go to Google, you find out, and there's much less filtering of knowledge. So we have the world, we have an empire of information at our fingertips. When it comes to UFOs, yes, the water has been muddied, but still, it's much better than a world without it.
This is true. We have become the information age, information literally at our fingertips.
And it's going to have a profound effect on the human consciousness and perhaps the future generations. We are going to mold and adapt to this, to our changing environment, and you know it's part of this ongoing evolution. Not only our spiritual development is part of this, but also the information and the rational side too.
And also, different conferences get information out there as well.
Yep.
But I was thinking, you know, on a lot of these conferences, you've already got people there that are, you know, either A, had a sighting on their own and want more information, or B, people who just, you know, are already into the subject and know quite a bit about it.
Yeah.
Do you think conferences are useful, or are they, you know, to...
No, absolutely. Because nowadays, even more so, because you have not only the conference and the hundreds of people that attend it, but you have the videos that come out of it and live on the internet. And that's where the real juice is, because one conference can generate a few hundred people, but the videos can reach tens and tens and tens of thousands of people worldwide. So we're getting better quality video from these things and better dissemination of the information at them. So yeah, I mean, look, every field of study holds conferences, from medicine to science. So yes, the apparatus of the conference and its effectiveness to get information out is still unsurpassed.
Well, do you think that, you know, some of these conferences are just preaching to the proverbial choir?
There might be some people in the audience that know some of the stuff already. Yes, but again, now that all this information is going way beyond the 200 or 300 seats at this particular hotel, then the impact is that, yeah, some people there might know a thing or two about a thing or two, but the overwhelming reach of these things goes into the many of thousands.
This is true. After going to the Roswell deal last year, you know, part of it was a real zoo, and a lot of it had some really good information.
Yeah, maybe, you know, if you go see a lecture, you might know some of it or all of it. If you go to every lecture and you know all of it, well, yeah, I think that's highly unusual. But yeah, most of the times when these things come together, you do get people pulling information that people in the field haven't seen. And I think that holds true for ufology for the most part. And some conferences I know do seem like they go around in circles, but I haven't been to any lately that fit to that category.
This is true. A lot of them that I've gone through have been really good and very, very, very informative. You get to meet researchers that you probably wouldn't have heard of otherwise.
Yeah, absolutely.
And all that. And on that note, we need to go to a break. We'll be back here in a little bit on Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis, here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
I think we might be back, no?
Uh-uh.
Oh.
And welcome back to Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis, here on UFO Paranormal Radio Network. I'm your host, DeAndrew, and tonight my guest is Rob Simone. Rob, we were talking before the break of you know, the media and how everything is working. To kind of backtrack a little bit, I've always had an interest in ancient astronauts, and I noticed that you have a deal on your website about the Aborigines and 2012 prophecy and legends.
Yes.
Would you like to go into that a bit?
Yeah, about the about my lecture about the Aboriginal abductees of Australia.
Oh, cool!
Is that the one you're referring to?
I believe so. Yes.
Because I also sell past copies of my radio show, and one of them is with Zachariah Sitchin, and we talk about this incredible model that could depict an Anunnaki in a spacecraft that was dug up in Turkey that we both sort of discovered in Istanbul at the History of Archaeology Museum. But yeah, you're referring to the Australian research, no?
Yes.
Yeah, the Australia is an interesting place, and I lived there in 2000. I lived there for a year, and I started in this field working with CAUSE, Citizens Against UFO Secrecy, in Sedona, Arizona. And I was paralegal, and I was helping Peter Gersten, the UFO lawyer, sue the government to get information about UFOs. We were, CAUSE was the first organization to do that, to use the legal system to end the government truth embargo. And so I did that for a year in Sedona in the late 90s. And that's how I got into this field and met all the players, got my feet wet, became the world's first paranormal paralegal, had a lot of fun. And, of course, being in Sedona, you're exposed to all this, you know, very spiritual, you know, very esoteric teachings and experiences and opportunities to learn from shamans and other Native American sort of medicine men. And quite extraordinary. But I did leave the country to travel around the world, and Australia was my first stop. So I was fresh in my mind, all these things ufological. And I made my way to the outback, right near Alice Springs, which is where the big outcropping, the rock they call Uluru.
Ayers Rock?
Yeah, which is called Uluru by the Aboriginals, and Ayers Rock by most other folks. And I started to look around, and it's very harsh out there. Australia boasts a very, very difficult climate. They have the most poisonous snakes and insects. It's 110 degrees out there in the outback. But I love it for some reason. I was little did I know I'd end up in the Middle East where things would get even hotter. But I started to explore their history. And the Australians have what they call a dream time. And the more I learned about this dream time, in tribes near Kimberley and other places, that there were certain components of it that sounded to my ears like the classic creator god, Anunnaki, star people visitations that I've studied in so many other cultures. And they told me these incredible history lessons that had to do with their creator gods. And I go about this, I have a whole presentation I do with PowerPoint, and I got all these pictures, but to give you a sense of it, I mean, it's stunning to think that their artwork reflects humanoid beings that look exactly like the gray off of the Whitley Strieber book, Communion. It's stunning to think that they're described in similar ways, that they come down in craft that look like eggs, shaped like eggs. They talk. They don't talk at all. They just point to the things that they want. They impart knowledge to the ancient aboriginals about the communication and words and things, and about the nature of the universe. And they have been known also to change shape. Some of their legends talk about the creator gods coming down and shifting forms into animals, which really opens up a whole other area of research to people who have an understanding of this comparative mythology. But when it comes to the Aboriginals, I hesitate to call it mythology, because they have an extraordinary oral tradition that a lot of people might not be aware of that is still intact, and the women really are the keepers of this knowledge. I remember sitting around a fire out in the outback, and I had made it sort of a makeshift living arrangement. I had bought a car when I first landed for a few $100, an old Toyota, and worked really well, drove it all around, and I sort of propped up some poles, some tents, some stakes. And believe me, for where I was, it fit right in. But we were sitting around a campfire, and one of the elders was telling a story about one of these particular dream time encounters. And as he was telling the story, I saw him look over to his wife that she was sitting sort of behind him, and she would give a yes or a no or a nod at different parts of the story that he was struggling to remember. And a day or two later, I sort of came to my mind that she really was the one who knew the story. And it was from that point that I managed to get some direct contact with the elder women of some of these tribes who really had the information and that laid the foundation for chronicling the events that took place in antiquity, in their dream time, and also what happens to them right now. Because it's interesting to think that they too have these UFO encounters, they have these abduction phenomena, they have these phantom pregnancies amongst the women out in the outback that is hard to explain, but we also see that in other parts of the world, and that particular phenomenon has been reported on in mainstream medicine, and it has been linked to the UFO field insofar as we see these cat mutilations that are, and we see these thousands, tens of thousands of reports of abductions that seem focused on our reproductive activities. So it's one thing to consider the idea that they use women for some sort of biological experimentation, some reproductive experimentation, where they are carrying to term perhaps a hybrid, alien-human hybrid baby, and they are later abducted again, and the second or the singular fetus is removed. It certainly would not be out of the realm of possibility for a culture that has matured thousands of years beyond us. And when you come and get right down to it, this is my opinion.
Do any of these women or the men that you know face this, do they object to it like a lot of abductees here in the States do?
Well, they have very little, you know, they're not up on this stuff. But I doubt they'd have any problem with it. But what I was going to say is, in my opinion, when you step back and think about humans or any race that has been around for, say, 20,000 years or a million years. So, you know, look at our own. We're evolving. It's such an extraordinary pace. Our technology is doubling. And if you extrapolate that out, say our can you imagine our technology 5,000 years from now? It will be off the charts. So a civilization that has this kind of technology, that's zipping around the cosmos. The only currency left in the universe is DNA. Because you can't create DNA from scratch. You can manipulate the hell out of it, but think about it. You're not interested in gold or diamonds or anything else. The only thing left is what we're made of. Because that holds the real secrets of the universe and the fundamental understanding of creation. So when we think about all of these reports that have to do with our reproductive processes, these alien-human hybrids, I know it sounds like it could be at the far end of spectrum of believability, but when you think about the ultimate currency in the universe, it's not too hard to imagine. So that's some of the stuff that went on in Australia. And their artwork, also, the stuff that I present in my lectures is just absolutely stunning. I mean, the grays, these images, it's spot on. Gray alien typefaces with the large eyes and the iconic shape. Wild stuff. And they've been painting these things for thousands of years.
In your 3-year trip around the world,
yeah,
you've probably seen a lot of interesting ancient sites.
Oh, yeah.
What's the most interesting place that has been, as far as ancient site or society, that you feel has a strong UFO connection?
That's a great question. I have been to so many, I'm hard-pressed to think of just one. But when it comes to this specific UFO sort of a tie-in, well, let's see. I mean, gosh, there's so many.
Well, it wouldn't have to be just one. You know.
Well, right. Yeah, I'm... Well, let me think. Well, you know, there is something to be said for the NASCAR lines of Peru. Not only because they're only visible from several thousand feet upwards, but in that area, beyond what we've all known and seen, the spider, the monkey on the lines in the plateau, the mountaintops near that area, some of which have been highly manipulated and leveled off, feats of engineering that would boggle the mind today. Massive humanoid sculptures written into the mountainside, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of yards long, massive undertakings of engineering that if you placed any reasonable conjecture upon would only link to someone coming down from the stars. And a repeated occurrence of this in a culture based on reflecting that and perpetuating this. So we've seen that. We've seen this in the temples, in the tombs. We've seen this in Egypt, in places in the Middle East. There are many cultures that have this underlying current to it. It can't be coincidence. It can't be.
I agree. I've always felt that this little insignificant speck of dust has been of interest to other worlds for a very, very long time.
Yeah, absolutely. It's woven into the collective experience of humanity. It is the yet unreported component of our human civilization. And that's what my focus has been on, is researching this, illuminating it, bringing back the physical evidence, the photographic evidence that suggests this. I was on Coast to Coast AM just a few days ago, and I was talking to George about my travels to the Middle East. And this is not something that a lot of people may know, but I could be one of the only people in the world that has actually photographed Jacob's Ladder. And I never really talk about it because to me it's so extraordinary that I have a trouble putting my own mind to it. But it's in the first book I wrote called UFOs, Crop Circles, and the Mayan Calendar. It's a collection of articles. It's on Amazon. It's also at robsimone.com. And in it, I talk about the mysteries of the Middle East, going through there, living on a rooftop in Jerusalem, and over the Dome of the Rock, which is the most holy place for all three religions. It is where the temple, Solomon's Temple, used to stand, where the Ark of the Covenant.
Yes.
Yep. It's where the Ark of the Covenant was housed. It's where Muhammad ascended into heaven. It's where Jacob was going to, the sacrifice. It's where Jacob saw the ladders extending into heaven. It's the foundation stone of the world. It's thought that that area, that rock, was the first part that God created when he made the earth. So, I mean, it just is the linchpin of all these different religions. And one night, I saw this black beam coming off at an angle from the very base of it, and it flared slightly. But this black beam went all the way to the sky, I mean, way up there. Jerusalem is not a big city. There's not that much light pollution. And even so, with that much scattering, a shadow going straight up could not last very long. It couldn't be that defined, but it was. And I actually managed to photograph it on a couple of different occasions. And this was confirmed by all the people. In fact, there was a guy in Canada who was with me at the time who sent me one of his photographs of it. And you can see it very clearly, and it is photographed in my book, UFOs, Crop Circles, and the Mayan Calendar. And the thinking is that whatever energy exists at this most holy of holies, the most sacred place on this earth, hands down, might have been some sort of representation from the energy that exists from the heaven to the earth. That could be the connecting point. Because if Isaac was going to sacrifice his son there, if Muhammad was going to ascend it into heaven, you know, if Jacob saw this ladder, what are we talking about? We're talking about a gateway. So this is something that is truly extraordinary, and I thought that was unique until, and I didn't get to say this on Coast to Coast a couple nights ago, but somebody sent me some photographs of Antarctica during the 50s, during an expedition there. And in these photographs, I saw, and it's clearly visible, the similar type of black beam from the horizon to the sky, at an angle. So this is a whole new, brand new area of research that I have consulted with various people. And as I say, it could very well be that some of these ancient gateways or portals that are spoken about in the Bible and given colorful language and woven into these biblical stories, if we can unwind that part of our mind that identifies these phenomenon with classic Bible stuff, if we can subtract the Bible stuff and any sort of convenient or even negative or familiar identification we have with Bible stuff and just get down to the real story, then we see that, yes, there are connections to heaven and earth that have existed. The Nephilim, and you look at Genesis chapter 5, or the Nephilim come down to earth and are mating with the women, and they're giants, and they're called the sons of gods. Ezekiel, the wheel, and the book of Daniel, and all that went on there, we see that there are true connections that come down and manifest on this earth into humans that go beyond a clear divine explanation, and that is mirrored in every other sacred text, then we can draw some very serious conclusions about the nature of our universe, the energies at work that go beyond our limited Newtonian established scientific framework. That's when you step out, and that's when you step on to the real truth of the world, is that we have been lied to, we have been manipulated, and we've just been kept in the dark. And people need to step outside of what they've been led to believe and realize there's much more going on, as scary as that might be, and embrace it and explore it if they have the guts to. I did. And a lot of people listening do, too.
Yes, I agree. On Wednesday night on UFO Hunters, mm-hmm. They had a program called UFO Vortexes. And do you think that some of these ancient sites that they were talking about, for example, they were going to, like, Sedona and checking out the vortexes there, mm-hmm. Stonehenge, these what appear to be possibly Nordic-constructed stone structures with megaliths and whatnot, do you think that some of these sites have more connection to UFOs than we may not be aware of, you know, like hidden properties that we may not know about fully?
Mm. Well, yes. I think there are certain energies and ley lines and certain places that are you know, prone to these kind of things. But when it comes to UFO hunters, I know the people that put some of these shows together. And basically, it's some people, some researchers, some people who are just in TV and sit around and say, well, what's our next episode going to be? And wouldn't it be cool if it was here? And a lot of it has to do with location. So when it comes to television shows, a lot of it has to do with just putting an episode together that it could be digestible to middle America. But the truth of some of these places is that, yes, they do exist in different dimensions, and they do have a certain power. Whether it's too easy to say that there's a UFO connection, because that's just too blunt of a tool to dissect the complex nature of some of these phenomena and some of the areas that they're associated with. That's why when it comes to television shows, they have to deal in the blunt and the obvious and the simplistic. Whether, you know, or not that these things are true or not, yes, you can go there with a camera crew. You can talk to some people, get some stories, and yeah, you point your camera up at the sky long enough, you're going to get something. But yeah, Stonehenge is certainly a place where people have experienced some extraordinary realities, and I don't think any place is off limits for extraordinary phenomena. Whether it has to do with ley lines or the rocks themselves at these different places or the sacred geometry, there's still a lot of room for discussion, and I don't think they're all mutually exclusive. But yeah, some sacred sites do have a powerful energy, like the vortexes in Sedona, that have been disputed and criticized and confirmed by all sorts of folks.
You know, I used to think a lot on different, my own stupid, well, maybe not so much stupid, but, you know, my own theories on like ley lines and whatnot and connections with UFOs. I always wondered if maybe these ley lines, since they're the Earth's power grid, for lack of a better term, they're using this energy as a highway
Hmm. Yeah, and that's a good way to put it, because it is, it does direct and carry energy as far as I've been able to discern. I used to live in England. I did a radio show out there in 2000. I've been on the air ever since. And although I live in Los Angeles now, but yeah, the ley lines, to mark them, they would put stones on them. And you go out to the countryside in England and you'll see them all around. And funny enough, after Christianity started to take hold, the church established their churches on the same places where these pagan landline stones were or once stood. So they knew enough to follow along with these energy patterns, because all the churches out in the countryside were placed where these marking stones once were. Some of them still stand because you can't put a church everywhere. But yeah, they understand this sort of technology, and it has to do with a subtle understanding of these energies that do not fall into any mainstream scientific explanation. But yet, the real earth religions, the pagan religions, were free from any persecution as far as their beliefs and knowledge was concerned. And we have them to thank for this understanding, because it's lucky that religion and science hasn't wiped out everything, because this esoteric knowledge could be the very key that gets us over this hurdle that science now finds itself up against when they try to come up with a unified field theory without incorporating consciousness into the equation. So we find ourselves again in a very interesting place in the universe, and to me, this is where it all started. I mean, I started my crop circle research out there, and I was able to come up with some very interesting observation theories about frequency-specific energies relating to crop circles. And actually, we talked a little bit about that on Costa last Tuesday. And again, it is in my book, UFOs, Crop Circles, and the Mayan Calendar, which is at robsimone.com and, of course, online. And there are pictures in there, too, of not only these formations, but an idea, an understanding that whatever is laying down these crop circles seems to only affect the particular type of plant that they are interacting with. Because I found a whole bunch of other plants interwoven with the wheat itself that was untouched. And funny enough, these other plants are much, much lighter and weaker and much more susceptible to any kind of force. Yet they seem to be completely unaffected. So it seems to me that some of these crop circles, the ones, in my opinion, that were genuine, or at least I could rule out that they weren't man-made, seem to only affect the intended medium to which they were directed to.
Have you done any research into the Vedic texts, such as the Mahatharaba, dealing with the Vimanas, as a clear-cut description of some kind of an advanced technology?
Yeah, I have. In fact, when I traveled around the world, the only book I took with me was the Bhagavad Gita. And it's an area that really was important to me in starting me off. And yes, it's interesting to think that this ancient text does talk about in such great detail these men in these flying machines, and not to mention their exacting scientific language. They talk about atoms. They talk about numbers. 0.000008. These very, very detailed numbers that you would think in antiquity they would have no use for. But again, we have to redefine what technology is and what it was and where we are, because we are not at the head of the table when it comes to civilizations who have already been on this planet that have perhaps been far ahead of us in some ways.
I agree. There's so many ancient texts in even historical writings of these ancient societies that point to the possibility of things being visited from other planets.
Yeah, it's And not only that, I interviewed Dr. Albert Haldeman. He's the head of the rover missions for JPL. And he's the guy that's responsible for the Spirit and all these unmanned missions to Mars. And at the end of the interview, he told me that he thought life on this planet originated from Mars. That is, somehow, things got started over there and worked its way here. And coming from someone in his position, I found that truly stunning, which goes to show that a lot of these guys in mainstream science, while they might be towing the party line, still, they are getting a growing awareness that there's a lot more happening out there, and they're just waiting for the coast is clear that they could stick their head above the radar and say something about it.
Oh, well, it's like a lot of mainstream science won't even think about looking into the UFO subject, or even unaccepted archaeological finds.
Well, that's the other thing. There's a lot of stuff that doesn't fit into the historical record that gets set aside or put in a very small box inside the Smithsonian Museum, for example. And this is something that, I interviewed Michael Cremo, author of Forbidden Archaeology. And
yes.
He's a friend of mine. He lives not too far from me. He lives in Los Angeles. He is a devotee of Krishna consciousness, which not many people know, but he is well educated on the Vedic text and the knowledge, and he comes at life with that backdrop. And he talks about this in a way which leads you to believe that so many discoveries have happened that absolutely defy description or explanation by our current view of archaeology from the established sort of edifice. And it is sometimes a case of intentional cover-up, and it's also sometimes a case of knowledge filtering, which means that this anomalous data gets set aside, it doesn't get reported on, and then the next round comes out and you never see it again. It happens in a lot of fields, but slowly but surely, when we get a better look at what's underneath the ocean off the coast of Cuba and Japan and these underground temples and pyramids that have been machined, because the real truth is really under the water. Underwater archaeology is a really big part of where we are going to find answers to some of the questions that people have been asking for thousands of years. And Graham Hancock is someone who's doing some great work in this field, and it's something that I'm interested in and trying to mount some television projects together so we can get some funding to go out to key places where I know a guy that he was a navigator for the Navy, and he is a very down-to-earth guy, really smart. He doesn't live too far from me either. He lives in Pasadena, and while on they actually got blown off course. They were on a very large naval vessel. He was a navigator. And they got off course, which does happen quite a bit, and they went over some area of the ocean that they normally don't go over. And you got to remember that these naval ships have incredible sonar, and map the bottom of the ocean floor. So they can look down and get a really good 3D image of what's down there. And he told me that he came over this one part where he saw his rangefinder going up to a point, and then drop off down as evenly and steadily as it came up. And he reckoned that the only way that that could have done what it did was if there was a massive pyramid underneath the Atlantic Ocean that's still there, and that is bigger than any pyramid that anyone has ever seen, whether it be Egypt, China, or elsewhere.
Well, and then a lot of underwater cities are supposedly off the southern coast of India as well.
Yeah, and that really is not something that is out of the range of possibility because, you go back 10,000 years at the end of the last ice age, the topography was a lot different. And the water level, we know, was in a different place. you know, was a lot lower. So we know that the areas of India and Cuba and Japan, for example, where the water levels were much lower 10,000 years ago, would have been a place that would have been on the coast, and it would have been reasonable to think that they had constructed a city there. So yeah, there are all kinds of cities that were at the old watermark, so to speak, that are now well below the ocean level. And what is the rubbing point for modern archaeology is that they don't feel as though the civilizations could have erected such complex things 10,000 years ago. Their dials aren't set for that. But the truth is they're going to have to reset all kinds of dials, because the pyramid itself, Giza, could be 50, 100, almost a million years old. The Sphinx could be far older than we're led to believe. Mankind could be far older than we're led to believe, which is Michael Cremo's whole supposition. And it will be interesting to see how these truths come out, because they're being resisted on every level. Academia, and a lot of times these guys are, you know, Bible believers, so you'll see a religious sort of a tendency to want to suppress this information. God forbid it hasn't happened before. You know, nobody's ever heard of anything called the Vatican or the Crusades, where they burned all kinds of stuff. You know, we've seen a precedent of this before, so the chances of it happening again in more subtle, more modern ways are very clear.
We have several people in our virtual auditorium that are commenting on your interview with Dan Burrish in Laughlin there last month, and they're kind of wondering what your thoughts are on Dan and his story.
Yeah. Well, here's an update that is really an exclusive update, because I don't think I've spoken about it on my show, but Dan recently, when we made the announcement at that lecture where Dan was going to be speaking at Caltech, and it did happen, and I was there to witness that, he gave a very scientific dissertation, and I've been waiting for them to put together the video of this, because it's perfect, because people can go in and they can take this information and pick it apart and let the world decide whether what he's talking about is real or whether it's not. And believe me, nobody there at Caltech, including department heads that were sitting in the audience, had any reservation or skepticism after he was done. But what he was talking about was these portals, these slides that he's working with microscopes. He's activating them with electricity and laser light. It gets a little technical, but I was doubly impressed by that presentation. And J.J. Hertak was there, and we hang out afterwards and had dinner, and we talked and talked and talked. And Hertak, as he's throwing in with Dan, J.J. Hertak, of course, wrote The Keys of Enoch, which is just an amazing book. I was looking at this the other day, and it's just something that's hard to be believed. But there is a new chapter of this. I'm trying to get a link set up on my website to where people can watch this. This recent Caltech presentation on YouTube or something. If people check in, I have a link section where I'm going to put all this stuff, my website. If you go to www.robsimone.com, that's R-O-B-S-I-M-O-N-E, robsimone.com, click on the links, and hopefully within a day or two, if my webmaster already hasn't put it up there, we'll have a link to where you can see this. And this will be important, because it's not just him talking about his life. It's just him presenting his data in a very scientific setting. So that could be a real big turning point for people who are on the fence or people who might not be a believer at all. I think this might really go a long way to establishing him as someone who has credible information to impart.
And what's your thoughts on his story?
My thoughts are, I've known about this for years, and I've seen I've seen the inside of all this. I've seen stacks of documents that most people don't get to see, and I've spoken with him and people surrounding him, and you know, there's so much to the story that really has never come out, that it's just absolutely mind-blowing stuff. With all of that, it's hard as it is to believe, even for someone like me who's heard and seen everything, when it comes to time travel and stargates and Men in Black, it is something that does test the limits of believability. But with Dan, as there have been no red flags thus far, as there, in mine and really anybody else's opinion, there has been no clear case where he's been proven to be deceptive in a way in which that would rule out any of his information, I have to, at this point, continue to go forward and go through this information and say, well, all right, at this part I believe, and now let's move on to the next part. Because when it comes to the science that he's presenting, I can follow along with it. So I understand when he's talking about biophotonic energy, and when he's talking about unidentified bundles of energy that has come through. We got into this with, you know, in pretty excruciating detail. I questioned him about the spectral relations with the equipment he's using and the calibrations of the equipment that he's using. So far, as far as that goes, and this has been confirmed by other people, then yeah, I do believe he knows what he's doing. He has done that. Whether he's actually been inside Area 51, I can't prove that. But if the rest of the story checks out, then I have to then take a friendlier view to all the rest of the information. So as it's going now, he seems to be someone that is clearly a genius microbiologist, is clearly well-educated on biology and molecular sciences. And as far as the rest of the story goes, well, we're getting there. We're getting there.
It's interesting because I've read a lot of stuff that backs up what he's saying, you know, and then other things that saying, oh, well, he's making all this up. You know, it makes it very difficult to make up one's mind when you read all these conflicting reports about him.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff that most people don't get to see that will come out in time. So I'm way ahead of the game. Because I've been, you know, to these meetings where all the stuff gets presented that has not come out in the light of day. I mean, if I started a blog of all the stuff I've seen and heard, you know, I could do that. I just don't have the time. So I have a unique position of having gotten a lot more info than most people have just by surfing around. So for me, it's hard to look at it objectively. But I can, you know, appreciate someone who hasn't had the benefit of my inside knowledge coming at it through just the web or what they've seen or heard here and there. Absolutely. I would see 100% where you would be scratching your head and still think, oh, well, you know, this could go either way. So it's kind of a catch-22 in my position where, you know, I have seen a lot more than ever gets put out there.
Oh, that's an interesting twist there.
Yeah, and it will. I mean, the documentary, they're making documentaries on this, and the stuff is being compiled. It just takes forever. Because people, you know, I know how it works. I know Ron Gardner's working, the other people working with them. If it were me, I would do things differently, but it's not up to me. But they just can't unload this information. There's certain things that they can and can't do. There are certain things logistically. There's really, you know, there's a budget concern. So with all of the normal pressures and restrictions, they're doing okay. It could go quicker, but they're doing okay. But, yeah, there's a lot of stuff that most people haven't even seen. But if they saw what I saw... Yeah, they would have to, you know, they'd have to really give it a second thought.
You'll be speaking at the X conference, correct?
That's right.
You want to give us a little sneak peek,
sure.
So to speak, of what you're going to be discussing?
Yeah, again, I'll be talking about the concept of this UFO ET phenomenon from a purely journalistic perspective, and this will be centered around excerpts from my new book, UFOs in the Headlines, Real Reporting on a Real Phenomenon. And this is a 300-page book. It's got over, 350 newspaper articles, close to 400 newspaper articles from 1950 onwards. The first 150 pages are all chronological from England, and the rest from the New York Times. Articles I brought back with me from Turkey and Asia and around the world, and it's never been done before, but the information there has really been lost in time, so there's extraordinary revelations in this book about the 1952 Washington, D.C. encounter and a world of E.T. stuff. Again, direct from the headlines and newspapers. And that, again, is all available at robsimone.com. And I'll be talking about that along with Edgar Mitchell will be there, the keynote, the astronaut. Paul Hellyer, of course, everyone knows him. He'll be doing keynote. He's a former, a defense minister from Canada. George Norrie will be there. John Alexander will be there. Grant Cameron is going to be in attendance. Richard Dolan. Robert Evenegger, who I'm stunned that he's going to be there. He's a, kind of like an insider. Terry Hansen, who wrote The Missing Times, a great book about UFOs and the media.
Evenegger also did a UFO documentary once back in the 70s, didn't he?
That's right.
And it was hosted by Rod Serling.
Yeah, and he's got this footage from the Haldeman, supposedly the real event that inspired Close Encounters. So, yeah, he's kind of an insider. So, along with him, myself, and Tom Vallone and Jesse Marcel Jr., Bruce McAbee, and who else? Joyce Labudi, documentarian, Dr. Lynn Katai. It's going to be quite a lineup. And people can get more information through go to robsimone.com and click on upcoming events.
And the aviary panel that Bassett's trying to get put together.
Yeah, it's going to be... This one's going to be amazing. I have to say that the people that are coming to this thing, I'm just stunned. I'm stunned that he got, Evenegger there because he's so mysterious, man. He just shows up at these things and never says a word. So this is going to be a real mind blower, this one.
Oh, I wish I could afford to attend this year.
Yeah, George Norrie's going to be there, too. He'll be hanging out. And so I encourage people, if they're near Washington, D.C., or they can get there, they should head out there April 18th. Because it's going to be a landmark event. Also, the following Monday, the 21st, will be the press conference at National Press Club. All are invited. It's open to the public. And I'm sure we'll get a lot of mainstream news to capture and chronicle this important disclosure press conference. And, I'm going to be there. And I'm going to be calling for open hearings, congressional hearings on the subject. So I'm going to really stand up and demand to be heard.
We have just a little less than 3 minutes. If you'd like to tell any detail about any current projects you've got going, or
I've got a new thing happening here with people that are in this field. Of course, everyone like you and myself, we're program makers. We do radio shows. There's a lot of great videos that people watch and create, but DVDs related to the subject about crop circles and UFOs. And I've always been looking for a company that can disseminate this information and, at the same time, for people who make the radio shows, like you and myself, can generate some kind of royalty from it. Because I've always been asked, hey, are you doing podcasts? And I say, yeah, but I know they're worth something, and I just don't want to give them away for free. Enter eWorld Media. They're brand new. They have a high-definition media player that works on dial-up. You got to see this thing. It's gorgeous. And what they do is they take content like podcasts, radio shows, and DVDs and videos, and they put them up in a beautiful setting, very classy setting. And for the people who create them, it's a way to make a small amount of royalty or a big amount of royalty, depending on what you have, for your stuff. You make money in your sleep. Now, for everybody else, it means you can see the stuff for absolutely free. And I've known these guys for a year. They're actually publicly trading on the New York Stock Exchange. They launched February 8th. They're going to be massive. So if people want more information, just go to robsimone.com. It's on the front page. It'll take you right to eWorld. You just got to download the toolbar for free, and it puts you in eWorld forever for free. And you can watch movies and television shows. I was watching an episode of Ghost Hunters from the Sci-Fi Channel on this thing. So they're hooked up with all the major news and television and sports and all that stuff. And it's a great way we're actually helping them build like a big paranormal section. So there'll be tons of podcasts and places where people can go and watch this stuff for free. And as I say, for people who make these contents, I know a guy, he's making $100 to $200, $300 a month just on his podcast. And again, that doesn't come from people listening to it. It comes from the advertisers. that support that are on there. So it's a win-win. So that's a very big deal. It's going to be huge, and people should check it out.
That sounds like a great site.
Yeah.
We'll have to get people checking it out.
Yep. Just get the free boomerang toolbar. You can make it big or make it small. Use it, don't use it. It's up to you. And as I say, it's 100% free.
And on that note, we are unfortunately out of time. I want to thank you for joining us tonight, Rob. I appreciate it. Some great 2 hours.
No, Dee, it's always great to talk with you. The time went by really quick. Thanks so much. I look forward to coming back on real soon.
And hopefully you'll be at the Roswell conference because we're planning on attending that one and we can get together again.
Sounds good.
Okay. That's all the time we have for tonight. I want to thank everyone for tuning in and also thank all those who joined us in our Pal Talk Auditorium. Stay tuned for Voice of the People, hosted by November Hansen. Her guest tonight will be author, Barbara Culp. Also for my dear friend Peter Robbins, who is organizing the Roswell Trifecta of Conferences for 2008, please check out Roswell Mysteries, all one word, roswellmysteries.com/UFO. And join me again next Saturday on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network for another episode of Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis, when my guest will be Ken Storch. Until then, keep an eye to the sky, everyone. Good night. And I think that's the click that says we're clear.
Okay, wow, what a great.
I had a blast.
Wow, thank you so much. You are a fantastic hostess.
Well, I appreciate that. I try. I really try. I'm fine. Like I said, my goal is to educate people. And this is the only way I can think of to do it.
Mm. Yeah, cool.
Because I'm not much of a writer. When it, you know, short article or two here and there, you know, maybe. But I'm no writer.